to pieces when I look at you, 'cause you're mine.
It's a matter of time, I suppose.
Welcome to Watchmen Minute, where we're discussing the movie Watchmen from 2009 by Zack Snyder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Eric Nash.
My name is Travis Bowe from the Real Comic Heroes podcast.
And my name is Jonathan Howell from Minute Impossible.
Hey, welcome back, Jonathan.
Thanks.
Do you love Billy Crudup any more than you did yesterday?
Yep. I went to sleep and I woke up and I love him.
Okay, good.
Glad we're all
Let's take the rest of the week off then. We did a lot of good here.
Nope, I'm still going to rag on him. Can I start with the first thing? His pants are gone. You probably need to say which minute it is.
That's all right. That's all right. Minute 82. This is minute 82 here on Tuesday. And it starts with John hovering over Mars and ends with Lori being questioned by Agent Forbes.
Dr. Manhattan's pants are gone.
Pants are gone.
You guys gave me a naked minute.
Oh, yeah. That's what everyone wanted.
I have lots of notes on this, just this one part, because I'm like, he had his pants on when he was being yelled at, and then he magically went away, and did he just transport without, what's up with his pants? Can we talk about his pants? Does he own his pants? Are they real pants? Does he make his pants? I have so many pants questions. Mm.
It's a gradual denudening, as I've said before, that throughout time, it's when he's... When he's in time, whenever he's in time, it just depends on when he is in time, that whether or not he's going to have pants, because it's less later.
Yeah, you can gauge what era it is by the amount of clothing he has.
Okay, so he's always naked in the 80s?
Yeah, but I think by the 80s, or probably by mid to late 70s, he's fully nude.
So he spent a good 20 years with a tiny pair of pants on, and it was just too much. He couldn't handle it.
Yeah.
Finally, he's like, I have grown beyond these pants.
Yeah, yeah. In the 60s, he had like one of those old-timey 30s era swimsuits that the men used to wear with like the shorts and the tank top built into as one piece. So he started with something like that in the 60s and then went to just kind of the briefs. Kind of look. Mm. He stayed with that, I think, would probably be his longest running costume, if you will, the briefs.
And I love how this is the more odd part that we focus on, his nakedness, yet he's floating a couple feet above the ground.
Yeah.
Seeing somewhat cross-legged, maybe?
Yeah.
Well, that stuff's everyday things. Seeing some guy floating on Mars, I don't care.
That's fine.
Is he naked? That's always the first question I ask.
Mm.
It's the alternate universe's new yoga position. Yeah. Floating.
So, yeah, he's on Mars. Sweet.
Yeah. I like the photograph. It settles like on the Martian soil and just slightly curls. I don't know if that's like an atmospheric thing or why it would do that, but I just like it for some reason. I like the little touch as it hits the ground, just kind of folds up a little bit.
It's probably a different, there is different atmosphere. I mean, there is.
Yeah, yeah.
There is an atmosphere. It's just probably not conducive to pictures.
Yeah.
And then that's when this music, the music cue comes in.
Yeah.
In this minute. I did not know. This is something I learned from this movie. I didn't know this was done by Tyler Bates, the guy who did, for me, John Wick.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I didn't know he did the score for this. I was listening to the score. I'm like, why does this score always make me feel tense? Like this score, Watchmen's score makes me feel tense.
Yeah.
And then I was like looking him up and I was like, oh, he did John Wick. Yeah, because that's really tense too. Like the music, because he doesn't talk that much.
Yeah.
So, and he did 300 too, which is fine, but that's more like a bunch of guitar stings and like a bunch of wow type of stuff. That's kind of his thing. I think he's more of a rock composer, but it works in this movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and he did a great job with the Guardians of the Galaxy score. Mm-hmm.
It's sad that the Guardians of the Galaxy score gets overshadowed by, the mixtape.
Oh, sure.
So most people don't think of the score.
Because
most of it's like, oh, you mean all the old songs? No, I mean, there was a score.
I'm trying to look at the score, and I'm not certain. Because we've spent the last, 2 weeks or a week and a half with music by Philip Glass, that mm-hmm. it's completely separate from the Tyler Bates score.
So do you think this might be?
I can't remember where this music. I almost would guess that this is a Philip Glass piece because
when you say it, I would say yes. This feels like Philip Glass. Like it's very otherworldly.
Yeah, because I'm looking at the Tyler Bates score, and I don't see a track like a track title that would be something that I think is on the Mars. This Mars sequence, I think it's all
nothing called Naked Yoga.
Nothing, no Naked Yoga. There's one that I'm guessing this is part of the Philip Glass stuff. But
well, now I learned something else.
Yeah,
there was a composer and also some other music by Philip Glass.
Yeah, great stuff. We had a great guest on very recently, and he had a lot of information as far as the Philip Glass stuff and kind of where the music came from originally and all that. So
yeah, definitely.
Let's see. I was just going to talk about his line about, he says that they claim their labors are to build a heaven, yet their heaven is populated with horrors. So I was curious what you guys thought about this line.
It's judgy, but for the movie works because that's pretty much how he's going to feel at the end. I mean, it's his character.
Yeah.
It doesn't bother me. I don't like all these lines all the time, in a movie when they're like real
philosophical.
Deep. Yeah. Like, there's nowhere to turn, but there's always somewhere to turn. that you just said the same thing twice.
Right.
But it doesn't go against his character, and it makes sense. And also, he's talking to himself, so go for it, man.
Sure.
I would say the biggest thing for me is that, he's saying they. Yeah. He's talking about the whole human race. I believe we have a few bad eggs. And unfortunately, some of the good eggs even get a little bad when they are trying to fight the bad eggs.
Yeah.
It's almost like Ozymandias' plan is a little overreaching. Maybe.
Maybe.
And the fact that he doesn't really mind the plan.
Oh, yeah.
Dr. Manhattan, is... Definitely. I mean, he's not a bad guy, but he's on the side of this sentiment. You people are causing your own problems.
Right.
And you're going to destroy yourselves.
Yeah. That ties in to one of my notes perfectly because I guess I always, or when I was thinking about this line, I just assumed that this was a quote from somewhere, from literature or philosophy. But every reference I can find to this line about, their labors to build a heaven, yet it's populated with horrors, everything that I found when searching that line, it all goes back to Watchmen. So I guess that's an original, Alan Moore line that he came up with. So I thought that was kind of cool, just that it wasn't, something from somewhere else. But when thinking about, what he actually is saying here, I think it's meant to reference the idea, like you said, mankind, while we progress through technology and manufacturing, we're just making things worse for ourselves. We might be able to do things more efficiently, but we're polluting our planet, at the same time. So are we better off or are we making things worse for us? And then that takes me to one of my favorite quotes from movies or just flat out one of my favorite quotes comes from Terminator 2 when the Terminator says it's in your nature to destroy yourselves. So I think that ties in perfectly with what you just said, Jonathan, about, it's...
Yeah, we're always going to cause the worst thing to happen.
Right, yeah.
The worst thing doesn't just happen to the human race.
Yeah, it's like...
We create these problems.
Sure. What was it? Nobel, the, scientist Nobel created... dynamite and then was horrified, I think, when it went to, became a weapon, that kind of thing. Like it started to be used in to make bombs, it's not what he wanted to make, but so.
Mm-hmm. The Tony Stark of his day.
Yeah. The warmonger.
And that's usually, and that a lot of times is what happens to any of these science, especially it seems like Dr. Manhattan, well, he kept the name Doctor. So he is a scientist, I think, and that's the one part about his character that I always find interesting is that he looks at the world like someone who is a doctor and that wants to learn something, has a higher level of questioning and investigation about a subject. Instead of just writing it off, he wants to find the answer. Unfortunately, he's finding all the answers to be that were awful.
Yeah, not worth saving.
Right.
Yeah.
Even when he, you know, entangles himself with a woman or something, and something from his previous life, and it just doesn't even help him. So I think that level makes his character more interesting, in that he's still looking at all of us like he's God, and he sees us as a failed experiment, which is the same thing Ozymandias sees us as. He just knows he's part of it, and he's trying to come up with a solution. Whereas right. Dr. Manhattan doesn't want a solution. He just wants to leave because he's like, it doesn't matter what we do. It's never going to help. You're always going to destroy yourselves.
Right.
I want to know if there's a reason that the shot is set up so that he is blocking our view of the sun. We can see it just for a little bit underneath his ass.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
As the camera pans, so to speak.
Huh. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. You know, we can't. Is he an eclipse? What's going
right,
on?
Right. Yeah.
What's the idea there?
I think the next couple lines that he says about, you know, nothing's made, a clock without a craftsman, it's too late, always has been, always will be. I think that goes back to, Jonathan, what you were saying a little bit about there being too much like philosophical, you know, for the sake of being philosophical. Like, I hear those lines and they're quotable. They sound really good, but I don't know what he's really saying, I guess.
He's really just giving up. He may think that, you know, we are beyond repair. I've always felt like Dr. Manhattan gives up on us.
Yeah.
And that's what, not that it was his job to take care of us.
Right. And I think he even says, you know, yesterday he says, you know, I'm tired of Earth. I'm tired of being caught in the tangle of their lives. So he is, in a sense, giving up, but he's also just removing himself from the board, you know, which I can respect that. It's not.
Well, it's also a great line to end on, because sure. I like that they added back in the too late again. Because he says it's too late, and then it could have easily, the line could have been, always has been, always will be. That's it.
Right, yeah.
But he says, too late, like one last time, and it's fun because it's late.
Right.
He says it late.
I really like the sunrise on Mars and illuminating the clock. I think I like the movie clock here better than the design of the one in the book, because this one, you know, it's animated, it's moving like this perpetual motion clock, and I get a better sense that it is, in fact, a clock. Whereas the book, it just looks like a glass palace or just a bunch of metallic glass spikes, you know, and occasionally you see like a gear, you know, something with some teeth, but for the most part, it's all just spikes and spires and things like that. And it looks like the clock that he was gifted by his father earlier in his life. So like, I like that tie-in, but to me, the one downside though, here in the movie, everything is brown. I do wish that it had some of the vibrant colors that the book does, the like pink soil and things like that. But here it's just the earth is brown, or the, you know, soil is brown. The clock itself looks brown because it's just clear. So it's doesn't have the much color to refract. But so I will say it's not very exciting to look at, but I do like the movement of it.
I always wondered about that in the original graphic novel. The pink ground and like the bluish sky. I always wondered, is that an error? I was always like, that's an odd choice for colors.
Right.
Because the artist who did the comic book, Dave Gibbons, I think?
Gibbons,
that's right. Dave Gibbons, I love his artwork. Sure. His stuff's usually pretty close. I mean, it's like realistic, you know, to a degree.
Yeah, yeah.
I can bring this up here because this was a good place to bring. I was actually going to bring it up last minute, but I didn't. Dave Gibbons, I had forgotten. I went and looked up a bunch of his work, and I had forgotten he drew one of my favorite comic books ever. And it wasn't Watchmen. It was Superman Annual number 11. And it's called The Man for the Man Who Has Everything. And the whole point of the story, if you remember it, it's he gets a it's where Mongol gives him a it's Superman's birthday, and Batman, Robin, and Wonder Woman are going to the Fortress of Solitude to give him his gifts. And he's already opened one of the gifts from someone else when they get there, and he's got this embedded in his chest like this plant. We find out later, I forget the name, it's something Mercy. And it tells you your fondest desire. They've reused this flower since. But it's one of the best. I mean, it's drawn fantastically, and it pretty much is that Krypton never exploded, and that Kal-El lives on Krypton with a family, and his dad is a loser because he thought he was going to blow up, and it didn't, and he's a loser. Mm-hmm. And it's just and he has a child, and he has this life that he always wanted, and it's a crazy story. Pretty much he's having to fight the fact that this exists, and he finally rips the thing off, and is so mad at Mongol he like goes flying toward him and like punches him through like 18 walls of the fortress. It's a great comic book. If you've never read it, it's Superman Annual number 11. It's from the 80s.
On Supergirl TV show season or two ago, they did a take on it.
Yeah, maybe, you know, for Black Mercy, maybe
woman has everything. Yeah.
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 It's awesome. And so I was just wondering if that was a mistake in the graphic novel to have Mars be pink, or are they just going for it's red? And so they kind of went with a red thing.
Probably
to go along with his blue skin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And especially because they reserve red so much in this movie. You don't get a lot of red. It's generally blood, or in scenes of extreme violence. Like, there's a – in the raid on Moloch's place when they capture Rorschach, like there's a lot of red because it's he's fighting with the police, but it's really like the glow from the neon signage outside. There's not a ton of red in the book, really, when it's – especially if it's not blood, but – I'm guessing that's what it is. It's, the colorist is John Higgins, so maybe he just...
Or it could be the plates when they actually make the graphic novel. I mean, since they've reprinted it a bunch of times.
Yeah, right.
But sometimes the first one is wrong. I mean, that just happens. I have comic books where, whole plates are missing through... I have an Avengers one where it's just everybody's pinker than they should be. Huh. It goes for about 10 pages and then it's gone. It was just, just in the press run. Sure. So I'm sure however many hundreds of thousands of those comic books left. I just didn't know if that was meant to be, if in this movie they were just, it would have been interesting if they'd kept it pink and kept it more like bizarre, but I know they were trying to ground this and like a grittiness.
Mm, yeah.
Which they did well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we leave Mars, with the sunlight kind of hitting, I like the way it shimmers, as it kind of becomes hit with the sunlight. It's a nice touch as we're zoomed out into space, but then we jump to the special talent quarters where we've got men in hazmat suits, and they get the scanning the bra that we see, assuming it's the same bra that we see Manhattan kind of quizzically considering earlier. Apparently it's got some radioactive leftovers on it, where they dump it into a bucket that says, class 7 radioactive material with there's a different class levels. Even for radioactive material, it goes like 1, 2, and 3, and this is a 3. So I tried looking up kind of what the different classifications are and what all the meanings are on the labels and stuff, but it starts using like different language. I don't speak when it comes to radioactive material. So
yeah, I think it's one of those things where it's just like, we just need to know that he's radioactive, because going to come up again later.
Yeah. So what do we think of, we see the return of Agent Forbes. So, anything on this?
Other than the, he's only in it for a second.
Yeah, yeah.
I was focused more on the room.
Okay.
On the ping pong room myself. Have you guys talked about the fact that there's grass in there?
We have not seen this room yet, so no. I wasn't sure if we'd get into it this episode or if we'd get in it tomorrow. I'm fine either way.
Yeah, I was just amazed when I saw it that I loved the wallpaper. I was like, oh, this is great wallpaper. I wasn't paying attention the first time I watched it.
Sure.
The second time I watched it through again, I was like, oh my gosh, they have grass carpet or whatever. I don't know what in there where the ping pong table is. I'm like, that's weird.
Yeah.
I love it. It's very cool.
There are also leaves on the grass, and they look three-dimensional. Like, it looks like the leaves are sitting on the floor. Like, it doesn't look like it's printed, you know, or I don't know what this room is.
it's a playroom of some kind.
Yeah. I don't know. It's odd. I mean,
but then it has a really nice chandelier.
Yeah.
Or fancy-ish.
You know? Sure.
I'm sure if we were better at, interior design, it must be some sort of famous, maybe 80s, you know, like style.
Yeah. Well, you're onto something. It was, so Alex McDowell is the set or production designer, set designer for the movie. And he designed their like living quarters as if it was decorated by some famous designer, Jensen or something like that, who did the Kennedy's White House. Like they were responsible for decorating for some of, you know, very wealthy and the White House for a certain period. And so this was like in universe would be, well, if we have the world's most powerful being, we want to spare no expense and we want to get the best. So this space was in the production side of the movie. This space was designed by the best that the government could get, you know? So that's why you have the bedroom, which is the bedroom, and then this ping pong room are supposed to be references to the David Bowie movie, The Man Who Fell to Earth.
That makes sense.
I've not seen the movie, so I don't know.
Is he alive in this universe? Is there a David Bowie?
Yeah, we've seen him in the credits, in the opening credits.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
There's a scene with him and Jagger.
Yeah.
Sitting next to each other.
Yeah, I couldn't remember. I was like, I know that there are a lot of famous people in this movie.
Right.
Like, lookalikes.
Yeah. So yeah, the idea there is, yeah, this whole space would have been designed by someone with that works, you know, with the wealthy and like for the White House. So yeah, I'm pretty sure this scene is not in the theatrical. I'm pretty certain that it goes from.
I don't remember this originally. I've only seen it because I was saying earlier to Eric that I had watched some of the minutes on my DVD, and then I was like, oh yeah, I forgot this is also the director's cut, so I need to also make sure I'm watching the director's cut. I do not remember this part in there.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, I would have noticed that funky room. I mean, I see why they took it out.
Sure.
There's really not much to it. It doesn't, I wouldn't say it helps the scene. It's a nice transition into Silk's, flashback here in a bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not a important scene.
Right.
And that happens on director's cut. Sometimes they just put it back in because it was just for time.
Well, and it helps that a lot of the flashback material we've either seen already or we will see again in the movie. So we're not getting a lot of new material, I guess, aside from their – I don't know if it's in this minute. I guess it'll, I think, be in next – in tomorrow's minute where the interaction between her and Eddie. So – that's the only thing you really gain here in the director's cut in this minute. So,
and obviously the director wanted it in there. So
sure, yeah.
With something important. That's all. It's always interesting to see director's cuts. No, nothing in a director's cut is ever like, oh, if you'd left this in, this movie would be 100 times better. It's
sure
for those of us that enjoy these movies. It's just extra. They were like, oh, okay, I see why it was cut, but that's cool. I'm glad I finally got to see that. Like when my son and I watched the director's cut of all the Lord of the Rings of the Hobbit movies.
Oh yeah.
And they're like, they're nearly 4 hours. And I was like, yeah, I see why this 10-minute scene was taken out. It's dumb. And it's funny, and it makes you interested in the characters, but I was like, God, can you imagine?
That was one of the things, like, I love the Lord of the Rings movies. I love the extended editions of the Lord of the Rings. And then when it came to The Hobbit, like, I love the first Hobbit movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's better.
By the time I saw the last one, Battle Five Armies or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I saw that one in theater, I'm sitting there watching it and I thought, oh, here's a section where they're going to expand it in the extended. So I could tell when we were going to, like, basically transition from a section where they would add more later. And I really did not like the last Hobbit movie, but so I haven't watched it again. But yeah, I could just feel like it was being presented in a weird way. But
Billy Crudup's on it, so I'm on board. Yeah. I haven't gotten my dig in yet for this episode. There's my dig. Take that, Billy. Take that all the way to the bank.
Mm-hmm. My last thing really for this one is he talks about Forbes talks about their satellites have done a sweep of the entire planet or sweep of the planet. And I'm a little dubious of the fact that their satellites and I guess they probably have been upgraded with the help of, you know, Manhattan and maybe Ozymandias, but I still, like, it's a big planet, and, like, she's still wearing the same jacket that she had on during the fight, so I don't think this is a lot of time has elapsed since she broke up, she went to see Dan, they got in a fight outside in the alley, and then Manhattan, you know, disappeared. Like, I don't think this has been days or even, you know, a day. I think this is either, like, if that all took place at, you know, late evening, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock when he was on TV, and then this is probably like maybe 1 or 2 in the morning, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they would have grabbed her and gotten her, you know, started talking with her, trying to figure out what's going on here. Why did he get so upset all of a sudden?
So, but apparently they've had time to sweep the entire planet with satellites I don't know. I'm just a little dubious, like I said, but maybe with his particular energy signature, like he says, there's no trace of, like, maybe you don't need to, maybe the satellites don't need to physically rotate the entire, you know, you do a bunch of rotations, maybe because they're able to lock in to his signature, maybe they don't require the actual, I don't know, sweep. Like, maybe
did they put up satellites just to detect him?
Mm. I guarantee you, Ozymandias
already had him out there.
I don't think they would probably. They've been part of a plan. You know, it's one of those Batman things where Batman has a list of all the powers of his Justice League, and then Ra's al Ghul uses against him. That storyline, I think it's probably the same basic. You always know where someone is. Mm-hmm. And he might have done it under the thing with government. Like, look, we should probably have these for everyone's well-being, including Dr. Manhattan. But it's really so they can find him. He's the most powerful being on the planet. He's the only person who could stop Ozymandias also later on, if he so chose. And they don't. And I'm sure Ozymandias doesn't know this intent at this point.
Right.
So.
All right. Anyone got anything else?
No, that was my Mars Minute.
I'm good.
All right. Jonathan, why don't you hit our listeners with your plugs?
My plug is Minute Impossible. We watch Mission Impossible 1 minute at a time, and we love the movie from 1996. It's also got some plot holes, and it's not written as well as some parts of this movie, but, you know, it's super fun and a lot of action and suspense and lots of dumb voices. We do a lot of stupid voices over on that podcast. So come and listen. MinuteImpossible.com. That's it.
Very cool. We can be found on Twitter and Instagram at Watchmen Minute. And you can find us everywhere on iTunes and just about anywhere else by searching Watchmen Minute. And while you're over there on iTunes, you can send us a rating.
And we also have our Facebook page at facebook.com/Watchmen Minute. And our listeners group is called Crimebusters Listener Society. They're on Facebook, where we can talk a little more about...
Does the sun set on Manhattan's ass? Ooh,
there we go.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. All right. So this was minute 82. Jonathan, you think you make it back for an 83rd minute?
Yes, I'll be here.
Of this wonderful movie with a little Billy Crudup in it here and there.
Yep. I'm getting less and less, though, as the week goes on.
Yeah.
Feels good.
I think it's the last we see of him for a while.
Yeah.
Okay, so this was minute 82. Tomorrow's 83. We'll be back. And until then, who watches The Watchmen?
We do.
1 minute at a time.
Watchmen are over.